Okay, we have 5 minutes each for our speakers to respond or make additional points, and we'll start with Harry.
I wish I had 55 minutes instead of five, so I have to be very selective. First of all, on the question of the tariff, it may come as news to Professor DiLorenzo that the protective tariffs were first instituted by Jefferson and Madison, not by by the Hamiltonian party. Hamilton tried to get the tariffs, but he was not successful. And the reason why the protective tariffs first entered our system in the wake of Jefferson's embargo, which put the New England shipping interests out of business. And it was so the first protective tariffs were put in by I think in Madison's administration, and supported by John C. Calhoun, who agreed that at that time it was owed to the New England people to give them their infant industries protection, because they had been put out of business by the embargo, and later by the War of 1812 conducted under Madison's administration. Madison, by the way, had opposed both the bank and tariffs when Hamilton was Secretary of Treasury. He signed into law the second Bank of the United States and endorsed the tariff, said that it had been ratified by the people in subsequent elections, so he reversed his position on that. What happened in 1828 is also a very curious fact. 1828 was a crucial moment in the history of the tariff, because the national debt was just being paid off, and so the income from the tariff would produce a surplus in the treasury. And at that time, there was a great fear that a surplus in the federal treasury might be used to buy slaves, to buy the freedom of slaves. So the slave issue really underlay the tariff issue. But it also happened that in the committee, which was scheduling the tariffs, the people in South Carolina, and I think other Southerners, they moved to raise the tariffs to this abominable level on the assumption that they would be voted down on the floor of the House. And they got fooled by that. Instead of being voted down, it was voted in. But they were hoist by their own petard. But I'm not saying but in 1833, in the crisis over nullification, the tariffs compromise was reached. The tariffs were reduced. Jackson's force bill was repealed, and so there was a peaceful resolution of that. The question, I myself believe in free trade, and would be glad it could be implemented whenever possible. But in the actual conflict that led to the Civil War, we had two obstacles to free trade, and I ask you to think which one of them was the greater obstacle. One was the tariff, and the other was slavery. Don't we hear nowadays objections on the part of the labor unions to importing goods from China, which is made with slave labor? Is the existence of slave labor not a reflection upon the idea of a free commercial society? Now, it's absolutely true, and I agree with Professor DiLorenzo, that the Republican Party could never have been successful without the support of the tariff interests involved. The Free Soil Party and the Liberty Party were anti-slavery parties, which were, you might say, pure in their principles, but they had no chance of being successful on a national basis. It was the addition of the tariff interests which gave the Republicans the ability to carry their anti-slavery program into action. And it's in that light, I think, that you have to look at the whole question of the tariffs. As far as the Hamilton, the banks and tariffs and banks and internal improvements, contrary to Professor DiLorenzo, I think, and so other people have thought that Hamilton was the greatest Secretary of the Treasury we ever had. The assumption of the debts of the states and the funding of the debt through the bank produced an enormous prosperity in the country, and this was all done under Washington's administration. And if you want to speak of Federalists and people supporting the Federalist economic agenda, The first one of them was George Washington. Now, there's one thing that, on the subject of states' rights and state sovereignty, a document which is very seldom cited, but which is absolutely fundamental to understanding the status of sovereignty under the Constitution. And that is in the letter that George Washington wrote transmitting the Congress, the new Constitution to the Congress on September 17, 1787. And among the ironies of this letter is the fact that John C. Calhoun, in his discourse on the Constitution and Government of the United States, the sequel to his Disquisition on Government, cites the words that Washington used to support his position that this was a federal government and that federal meant one in which the constituent parts retained complete sovereignty. And he refers to the fact that Washington refers to the federal government of these states. Now, the truth of the matter is that the idea of the meaning of the word federal underwent a change from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution. Under the Constitution, the states gave up their sovereignty in the Calhounian sense. And if you have any doubt about that, let me just read a sentence from George Washington. "It is obviously impracticable in the federal government of these states to secure all rights of independent sovereignty to each, and yet provide for the interest and safety of all." So all the rights of independent sovereignty, or some of those rights, have been surrendered. With this, we are introduced to a unique American contribution to political science: dual sovereignty, dual federalism and dual sovereignty. The states are sovereign within the spheres of the powers that are reserved to them by the Constitution. They are not sovereign in those things which are delegated to the United States as a whole. And if you look at the things that are denied to the states in the Constitution, for example, they're denied the right to coin money. Now, throughout history, the right to coin money has been a symbol of sovereignty. If states do not have the right to coin money, they are not sovereign in the state in the sense in which would justify secession as a state right. My 5 minutes up?
Yes. Thank
I wish
you.
It was 5 hours.
We'll have time during the Q&A to pursue more of this as well. And now Tom has his 5 minutes.
Well, I wouldn't argue that two wrongs make a right. I would argue that Jefferson, that's one of the dumbest things he did, was the embargo. So he was a protectionist in his early days. That's a shame on him. I wouldn't defend him just because he's a Southerner or something like that. It's the matter is liberty to me. And the same goes with Madison or Calhoun or anybody else. And as far as anti-slavery, I'd just like to mention that I think that as far as the Republican Party's anti-slavery position, well, as Harry mentioned, Lincoln supported the Fugitive Slave Clause. And, you know, that's precisely why William Lloyd Garrison, the greatest abolitionist, the banner of his newspaper, declared that he advocated secession of the northern states from the Union, precisely because it would eliminate the Fugitive Slave Clause. It wouldn't be a matter anymore, and it would greatly have increased the cost to the slave owners of capturing their own runaways. And I think it was a brilliant thing on his part that he understood that this would undermine and ultimately destroy slavery. But Lincoln supported that in his first inaugural. He certainly did. And also, among the reasons he gave for being anti-slavery, quote, was one, free labor. It was labor market protectionism, economics again. He clearly said that they wanted to secure the new territories for free labor, for white labor, that wouldn't compete with slaves for jobs. And the second reason, another reason he gave, was the three-fifths clause of the Constitution artificially inflated the congressional representation of the Democratic Party, because it said that for every five slaves, you could count that as three people for purposes of determining how many members of Congress would come from each state. And in one of his speeches, he compared Maine and South Carolina and said because there were so many slaves in South Carolina and they were counted in this way, South Carolinians had more votes than people in Maine did in Congress. And so that wasn't a moral argument. So they weren't entirely moral arguments that the Republicans were making when we use the language anti-slavery. And Henry Clay, I quote him as saying, after the Tariff of Abominations was renegotiated and whittled down in 1833, that he threatened to defy the devil himself, as he put it, to raise the tariff rate once again in the 40% range. He's furious about that. But maybe that's all I'll say for now, and we'll have questions. Yeah.
Professor DiLorenzo thinks that it is a reflection on Lincoln's anti-slavery character that he supported the Fugitive Slave Act. But the Fugitive Slave Clause is in the Constitution, and Lincoln thought that any refusal to implement the right clearly defined in the Constitution would justify secession. You can't pick and choose which parts of the Constitution you like. Once you do that, then the Constitution is simply, as Jefferson said once, a blank sheet of paper. Jefferson said that when he was contemplating purchasing Louisiana, and having said that by purchasing it, he would make the Constitution a blank sheet of paper, he went ahead and purchased Louisiana.
Well, then he should have advocated a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Fugitive Slave Clause.
Okay,
well,
question.
That could never have been, it was not possible.
Wait for the microphone somewhere. And hold it horizontally and make it a question, not a speech.
Mr. DiLorenzo, given that the U.S. government would not buy out slave owners, can you address the assertion that the only way to end slavery, or that the strongest way to ensure the freedom of slaves, was to keep the Union intact?
Well, I think slavery, I don't want to quote, I hate to quote Alexander Stevens, because he'll accuse me of some vile behavior, but he once said slavery was more secure in the Union than out of it, and he agreed with William Lloyd Garrison in that regard, and that the Fugitive Slave Clause made it more secure. And there were other laws, too, that subsidized the slave owners indirectly, as far as that goes. And we may never know the answer, but the death is what bothers me, the equivalent of 5.5 million deaths standardized for our population today. When the rest of the world did find a way, it wouldn't have happened immediately, but England did it in 6 years. It took 6 years to end slavery in the British Empire. And as I said, I think African Americans didn't really achieve justice in this country until 30 or 40 years ago, in my opinion. And that would have come much, much sooner had we done what England did.
Rebecca, did you want to comment?
Sure. Yeah, I'd like to comment.
Go ahead.
First place, the idea that the federal government in 1860 should have offered to buy the slaves is a political absurdity. Any claim by Lincoln or his party to have any jurisdiction over slavery in the states would have been regarded, and justly regarded, as completely unconstitutional and advocating the overthrow of the Constitution. Now, during the Civil War, Lincoln did endorse a program of compensated emancipation. In his 1862 message to Congress, he proposed a series of constitutional amendments which would have authorized the federal government to reimburse states which adopted programs of compensated emancipation. He was very anxious. This was after the, or not after, but before the Emancipation Proclamation. The final one was issued on January 1st, 1863. But he did want to see to it that loyal slave owners were not expropriated by this emancipation policy. But he couldn't get the Congress to adopt. He couldn't get any representatives and people from Kentucky or Missouri, the border states, you see, to vote for it. And so we failed. This is the message to Congress, which ended with those wonderful words, "Gentlemen of the Congress, we cannot escape history, the fiery trial through which we pass to light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth." Well, it failed. Comparing what happened in England, after all, in England, the Parliament in Westminster was making laws for the West Indies, and the West Indians didn't have any representation in the Parliament. The laws were made for them, and they had to go along with it. There was no such power within the federal government to interfere with slavery, except in the by limiting the expansion of slavery. And it was Lincoln's belief, and I think the best economic analysis that we have of the American economy and the antebellum United States indicates that if the expansion of slavery had been ended, and if it was no longer possible for surplus slaves to be sold from the old states to new territories, that the pressure within the states to adopt programs of emancipation would become great enough to do that. In other words, Lincoln's belief was that slavery could be ended peacefully through the action of the states themselves. It couldn't be done through direct intervention by the federal government, but it could be done within the states themselves. And after all of the states north of the Mason-Dixon line had adopted plans for emancipation. Slavery was lawful in every one of the 13 colonies in the 13 states which were part of the declared their independence. By the way, Professor De Laurentiis is absolutely wrong in saying that the 13 states were recognized as independent, separate sovereignties. They were not. In 1826, Madison and Jefferson together, in making rules for the University of Virginia, resolved that the first of the documents which would be studied by the law faculty in the University of Virginia was the Declaration of Independence as the Act of Union of these states. The Declaration was a declaration of separation from Great Britain and union with each other. And the resolutions of the state legislatures or state revolutionary colonial legislatures on the road to independence, they almost all of them passed resolutions calling for independence and for union. But all those same resolutions said that in the Declaration of Union, the internal police of each colony should be recognized as binding. In other words, the origins of American dual federalism is to be found in the resolutions of the revolutionary assemblies authorizing the Continental Congress to declare independence. They declared independence and union together, and there was never any time in which any state was acted on the international sphere having diplomatic relations, and the Constitution itself forbids each state to have any diplomatic action on the. It could not act independently of the other states in the international arena.
Tom,
I actually did reread the Treaty of Paris where I came out here, and it does list each state by name in the Treaty of Paris, and also Lincoln's emancipation in the border states proposal. He's called it a war measure, not an emancipation measure, and he combined it with deportation. Any of the freed slaves would be deported to Central America, Africa, or Haiti. And that was his career-long position, was colonization. He took that from Henry Clay, and so he combined it with deportation.
Okay, right here. Dr. Jaffa, I want to ask you this. You are an opponent of legal positivism in most of your writings. I remember during the Boerker nomination, you made very big point of this. And yet you constantly uphold the Constitution as kind of sacrosanct, as opposed to the natural rights tradition that is enunciated in the Declaration of Independence. Now, if we do have unalienable rights to liberty, as the Declaration proclaims, then why does it matter so much to you that the Constitution somehow does not sanction secession? I, as a free person,
from a free country ought to be able to leave if I choose and take whatever is mine with me. And if a whole bunch of people want to join me, we ought to be able to do that because we have a natural right, an unalienable right, to our life, liberty, and our pursuit of happiness.
Okay. Is that for me or him? Well, it was addressed to me, so we have these unalienable rights, and in the exercise of these same inalienable rights, we agree with each other to form civil governments. Madison has an essay on sovereignty, which is a sort of simplified repetition of John Locke's argument in the second chapter of the second treatise. Should I stand up for if the people in this room were not citizens of the United States, if they were not citizens of any state or of any sovereign government, and if we decided that we needed to, for our own protection, first beginning with safety, and we, September 11th told us why we need each other for the sake of safety. For the sake of our safety, what we want, we need to have a government. And that government, for our agreement to form a government, we have to recognize, each one of us, that the right to life and to liberty and property of each one of us shall be protected by this government. No one of us can say that he deserves protection for the government to be formed, but not somebody else, or that somebody is entitled to more protection than anybody else. Anybody who demands more protection from the government than his fellow citizens won't be accepted as a fellow citizen. But once we have reached this agreement, and we then elect a government, and that government functions through the election for that government is one in which there's freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of association, so that it is a legitimate government, then that government commands our obedience. We have no right to reject our duty to obey because we don't like the result of the election, provided the election is conducted fairly and constitutional rights are observed. You cannot have free government if you cannot bind the people who participate in the government to accept the results of the election. And that flows from the exercise of our unalienable right to life that enables us and justifies us in forming legitimate governments. When those governments are formed, we cannot reject them because we don't like the results.
Tom, did you have it?
Let's let some more people ask questions.
Sure.
I've talked a lot.
Right in the back.
I mean, a lot of hands.
This is a question for both of you. Was it the consensus of the Constitution, of the members of the Constitutional Convention, that the Articles of Confederation had failed, and that when they entered into the Constitutional Convention, that they were surrendering voluntarily, knowingly surrendering their sovereignty in order to form a new Constitution?
The 43rd Federalist deals definitively with this question. There was no question, but the Constitutional Convention, simply as a convention, had no authority of any kind. It did not form a government, but it said that the ratification of 9 states shall then bring this new government into existence. The Congress of the Confederation transmitted the results of the to the country. The ratifications took place and the government came into existence. I don't know
Tom?
Well, Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island asserted the right to secede from the Union as a condition of ratifying the Constitution, and they asserted that right for the other states as well, and they were allowed into the Union after doing that, and so that is one thing that happened. Now, one other thing I want to mention was
that is absolutely wrong. You're just flat out wrong.
I quoted the Virginia. Thing in my.
They did not speak of secession as a lawful right under the Constitution.
Sovereignty.
It was an exercise of the right of revolution which they had recently exercised under the British Constitution, but you simply stubbornly refuse to recognize there's a difference between secession as a constitutional right and revolution as a natural right.
I disagree with that. I just
know you're wrong.
I think you're wrong.
I think you're wrong.
You're just wrong. You don't know what you're talking about.
I would like to ask both speakers to answer the question of the egregious amount of violation of the Constitution. If the South has been claimed seceded in violation of the Constitution. The Lincoln administration became a dictatorship in violation of the Constitution. Which of these two violations are the most egregious?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
If both the South and the North violated the Constitution, which was a more important violation? Is that a fair rendition of your point?
Well, I don't think I'm still not of the opinion that the Constitution says anything one way or the other about secession. Although William Rawl, whose book was used to teach all the cadets at West Point constitutional law prior to the war, he argued that there was a constitutional right of secession, but there aren't too many arguments like that. But I don't think it says one way or another. So I would say, without a doubt, during the Lincoln administration, that's why Clinton Rossiter and James Ford Rhodes called him a dictator, but a good dictator, because of all the violations of civil liberties. Even Mark Neely, he even writes in one page in his book, it's in there, I forget what the page number is, but political prisoners in the North, there weren't many of them, but some were hung by their wrists in water torture. And that sort of thing went on with William Seward's secret police. And so, and I don't think secession was unconstitutional, in my view.
Any questions on this side?
Dr. Jaffer, do you really believe that September 11th proves that we need a federal government to keep us safe?
I think we've had ample proof of that in two world wars as well as... Oh, I'm sorry. I think that September 11th reinforced the sense that that security of life and liberty and property depends upon government. I don't see how it can be protected in a state of anarchy where there are no national defense forces and no police. Of course we need government, and we need a federal government because we are a government of many states and one nation.
Well, since you're looking at me, I would one more point I would make is I think Lincoln destroyed the Union as a voluntary association of states. He didn't save it. He destroyed it. And I don't see why we couldn't have a union of states for self-defense measures like that. And with regard to your question, the federal government still doesn't allow airline pilots to arm themselves. So the idea that they're protecting us, I've been in airports a lot in the last couple of days, and it's kind of silly that they're protecting us with these procedures. But I'm not arguing against having a union or a federal government.
My question is also for Professor Jaffe, although I'd like to give Professor DeLorenzo a chance to comment on it also if he'd like, since I think most of the questions have been going to his opponent here. But in your closing remarks, Professor Jaffe, you mentioned that you thought Lincoln supported the Fugitive Slave Act because he didn't want to pick and choose from the Constitution because that would have ended up justifying secession. But didn't he, in fact, go on to do many later things that egregiously violated the Constitution and thus, according to your own argument, justified secession?
Right.
And as a second kind of follow-up to that, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about your thoughts of when exactly people do deserve the right to self-determination.
Well, in the first place, I deny that Lincoln acted unconstitutionally at any time during the Civil War. It was a Civil War. There were traitors in the midst of all of the free states. The possibility of recruiting soldiers and keeping them from deserting. There was lots of desertion on both sides in the Civil War, and there were, it just happens that there were more Confederate soldiers executed for desertion than there were Union soldiers. But there was plenty of executions on both sides. It was a terrible war, and nobody's, but the idea that the cost of the war is due to Lincoln is simply absurd. It was a terrible war because the country was deeply divided, and the question of the future of the nation, whether or not it would be based upon principles recognized as principles of individual liberty, or whether or not slavery would be become, whether the idea of one race dominating another race and would be accepted as a means for governance. Let me just read one short statement here that might interest you. Since the Civil War, in which the Southern states were conquered, against all historical logic and sound sense, the American people have been in a condition of political and popular decay. The beginnings of a great new social order based on the principle of slavery and inequality were destroyed by that war, and with them also the embryo of a future truly great America. That has been the position of defenders of the Confederacy, from Alexander Stevens to Thomas DiLorenzo. The man who said that was Adolf Hitler.
anything you want to say?
Anything I want to say? Well, I knew. Now I know where Harry's getting his political philosophy.
Well, okay. The anti-Hitler
school? I don't believe anything Hitler says, but if you want to quote him in your book, go right ahead. And I look forward to the next one.
Okay, way in the back.
Professor DiLorenzo, it really bothers me as a libertarian that you call yourself a libertarian and then claim to support states' rights. I think the essence of libertarianism is denying that states have any rights. So I want to know, how far do you want to take this? You've spoken in support of states' rights and asserted that peaceful secession and nullification are the only means of returning to a system of government that respects rather than destroys individual liberty. So I want to ask you this question. Now, the Confederate states, of course, they seceded to preserve slavery. We know that because the Mississippi Declaration of Secession said that our position is thoroughly identified with slavery, the greatest material interest in the world. What I want to know is how far you obviously support secession for slavery, black slavery. What I want to know, suppose a group of states wanted to secede to establish a society that, say, is based on the ritual kidnapping and raping of 9-year-old white girls. Would you support that as a state's right, or do you draw the line at some point between that and Negro slavery?
Is that a step up or a step down from the Hitler comment? I'm not sure. Well, on the issue, as I discussed in my book, the Deep South, slavery was the issue. That's when they seceded. But the Upper South, when Virginia voted on secession first, they voted 2-1 against it. And the Upper South, the Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, Tennessee, didn't go out at the same time the Deep South went out, and Lincoln was happy to have them in the Union, slaves and all. And so it's a little more complicated. They changed their vote after Lincoln launched an invasion of their sister states. And so I think slavery was more of an issue. It wasn't a zero issue in the Upper South. It was more of an issue, like you said, in Mississippi and places like that. So I don't think it's accurate to say that it was the sole issue in states like Virginia, because they voted to stay in the Union.
Just limit your answer to Mississippi. Would Mississippi have been okay to establish a society based on the kidnapping and ritual rape?
I'm not going to answer crazy hypotheticals like that. I would say if a state has a right to secede, if a right to secede exists, a right to secede exists, even if slavery was the issue, and we should have diligently worked to get rid of it peacefully. But no, I'm not going to answer crazy hypotheticals, child.
One thing I should mention is both of our speakers are dedicated to the abolitionist idea. They have different ways they think it could be best achieved. So just to clarify that. Other questions?
Dr. Jaffa, recently the online website of the Claremont Institute published a rebuttal article, I think it was called in Ray Kemp versus DiLorenzo or something like that.
Joe Sobering, right.
And one of the paragraphs, you likened the union to a contract, and there's lots of ways you could attack that analogy, but I guess the basic question is, can you find any parallel in modern legal terminology where one party to a contract claims the sole right to interpret it and also enforce that interpretation?
Well, Lincoln in his July 4th special message to Congress, 1861, said that the people of the South were a law-abiding people and they would not have undertaken to do what they were now doing if it hadn't been for the invention of an ingenious sophism according to which a state could secede from the Union without the permission of the Union or of any other state. Now, the ratification of the Constitution was a action undertaken by all the states which joined the Union and adopted the Constitution, and that was a contract between them and among them that they would abide by the results of the elections conducted under the rules of the Constitution, and that they could not act independently of the other states with which they had jointly and severally agreed and contracted to be governed by.
Any comment? We have time for one more question. How about the gentleman right there?
The gentleman with the purple shirt, brother, he's been crying for a long time.
Which one?
Professor Jaffa, it seems to me that your insistence on saying that as long as the elections are followed, people are bound to obey them, basically says that as long as procedure is followed, there is no recourse. No matter how unjust a law might be, if procedure is followed, there is no recourse. And I don't think that is consistent with an unalienable right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. In other words, the Constitution doesn't force all men to give up a right that is unalienable.
No, on the contrary, the Constitution exists to protect that right. The important point is that the Constitution exists to protect individual liberty, individual property. In fact, the most important of all of the rights, really, the foundation of all rights are the rights to private property. But the right to private property is a right of each individual human being to own himself. And so the idea of slave property, it contradicts the idea of private property, and the Southerners taking their stand on their property rights and their slaves were in effect taking their stand on a principle which was incompatible with the idea of constitutional government. It was recognized as a necessary evil at the time, and the justification for the ratification of the Constitution with slavery is that any alternative arrangement would have been more favorable to slavery than the Constitution itself. The Constitution created a government strong enough to deal with the question of slavery when it became what it did become in 1860. And the war was a terrible war, but it was a war for human freedom. And if the South had succeeded and if slavery had been extended, the United States or part of it might very well have been on the side of Hitler in the Second World War. We would not have been the bastion of freedom we have been in the 20th century.
Well, Lincoln, of course, when he was elected, said Southern slavery is okay. He promised not to disturb slavery where it exists.
He did not say it's okay.
Where it exists.
He had no legal power to intervene.
Slavery where it exists.
That he had no more jurisdiction over slavery in South Carolina than he did of serfdom in Russia.
Okay.
That was the nature of the federal
system. Stay in the Union and pay the tariff and you can keep your slaves is essentially what he was saying.
No, that's not true. No truth in that whatever.
I want to thank both of our... I want to thank both of our speakers, Harry Jaffa and Tom DiLorenzo. Copies of their books, A New Birth of Freedom and The Real Lincoln, are available upstairs for those of you who have not gotten copies. Both of them would be delighted to autograph copies for you and speak privately as well. And thank you all for coming and making this such a successful evening. Thank you again and good night.